This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Roger Ailes, the chairman of Fox News, has succeeded in turning a television news network into an unprecedented political force, writes our first guest, Gabriel Sherman. His new book is called The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. Sherman writes, quote, Ailes both remade American politics and media. More than anyone of his generation, he helped transform politics into mass entertainment, monetizing the politics while making entertainment a potent organizing force. Through Fox, Ailes helped polarize the American electorate, drawing sharp with-us-or-against-us lines, demonizing foes, preaching against compromise, unquote. The book is not just about Ailes' years at Fox News. It's also about his childhood, his years in show business, and his work as a political consultant. Sherman is a contributing editor at New York Magazine, where he's written cover stories on media, politics, and business. He spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Gabriel Sherman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you want to write a book about Roger Ailes?
Well, I set out to write a book about Fox News. I've been covering media for a decade now, and Fox is the most dominant media organization in America. It generates over $1 billion of profit. It is has the highest ratings of any cable news network. It doubles the ratings of CNN and MSNBC. So I knew that was a tremendous story. And very early on into my reporting, more than 3 years ago, I realized that the story, at the heart of the story, is Roger Ailes. You know, Fox News is a complete expression of his worldview. You know, he said in an interview several years ago, which I quote in the book, that he built this network from his life experience. And it's true. It is really amazing how this, you know, giant media organization is run as the expression of one man, and his rule inside the company is absolute.
You write that in the early years of Fox News, Ailes kept a healthy distance between his own worldview and the product on the air. How did that change? What are some of the things you learned that he does to control the political agenda?
It happens two ways. There's a morning meeting at 8 a.m., which is in his office. If he doesn't attend, he calls in by speakerphone, and Ailes will monologue and give his take on the news, and his executives absorb those ideas, and they know that that's the way Fox is supposed to play the stories of the day. He even goes beyond that. During the healthcare debate, Ailes was vehemently opposed to the healthcare reform, and he gave a Fox pundit a stack of the bills, a prop. He literally gave an anti-healthcare reform activist a prop, which was a stack of 2,000 pages of bills, and he wanted her to wave it on air to make that political point that this bill was, you know, massive and unwieldy and shouldn't pass. So both in his, you know, morning directives in the editorial meeting, and then actually in specific kind of programming instincts, such as handing out the healthcare bill, he is pushing his message onto the airwaves. Another way he does it is there are selected personalities on the channel that literally will take dictation from him. One example is his lawyer, Peter Johnson Jr., who is his lawyer, but he's also a Fox host. He occasionally will host the morning show Fox and Friends, and he offers legal analysis on other segments. And Ailes will give Johnson things to say. And one source told me that when Peter Johnson goes on Fox and Friends and says something incendiary, it's not Johnson, it's Roger plugged in. And so there are certain people, if you watch closely and you know how the channel works, that it's actually Roger Ailes is speaking to the camera, not, you know, he's using these people to speak for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gabriel Sherman, author of the new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, and it's about Roger Ailes. He's a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Roger Ailes really has had a very interesting life filled with twists and turns that I found fascinating that I didn't know about till reading your book. So I'd like to talk with you about the earlier part of his life before he joined Fox News. He gets his start in the entertainment business on the Mike Douglas Show as a producer there. And that was an afternoon variety show that I think started in Ohio and then moves to Philadelphia, produced out of Philadelphia for a long time. And it's a popular, but it's a very like middle-of-the-road show in its sensibility. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. The Mike Douglas Show was in many ways the antithesis of the late-night talk shows that were programmed out of New York and Los Angeles. It spoke to a middle-brow, middle-American audience. You know, the common saying was that it appealed to the millions of housewives who, in those years in the 1960s, were often at home watching television. And you know, Mike Douglas was a kind of washed-up big band singer. He was nearing the end of his career, even though at the time he was in his early 30s. And he clicked with that middle-brow audience because the seeds of the 1960s tumult were just percolating in the early 60s. You know, the Mike Douglas Show really took off from 63 to 68. And I think the Mike Douglas Show became a safe haven for the millions of Americans that felt that the culture was moving a bit too fast. And he was a genial, likable character, and the audience connected with that. And the other fascinating thing that Roger Ailes learned in his time on the Mike Douglas Show was how to create dramatic television, and that television is a medium that thrives on spontaneity, drama, likability, surprise. And you see all of those elements on Fox News. You know, the hosts are, even when they're spouting aggressive right-wing talking points, they do it with a smile. You never quite know where the segments on Fox are going to go. And on the Mike Douglas Show, the producers talked about every segment needing a payoff. And so they would produce the segment so that the viewer would get a surprise at the end. And I think that same DNA and that same formula has been, in a large sense, why Ailes has made Fox News the most successful network on cable news. It really is applying all of the best precepts of daytime television to a new medium, which is news.
It's through the Mike Douglas Show that Roger Ailes meets Richard Nixon and gets involved with politics. Was Nixon a guest on the Mike Douglas Show?
I love this story. This story gets to the heart of the creation myth of Roger Ailes. So in Ailes' telling, the way he met Nixon was that on the day Nixon was set to appear, as his 1968 campaign was just getting into gear, the Mike Douglas Show had booked a belly dancer named Little Egypt. And as Ailes has told it over and over again, it was his idea to stick Nixon in his office so that he would be spared an awkward encounter with an exotic dancer in the green room. And it was in that encounter where Ailes talked himself into a job with Richard Nixon by telling Nixon he needed to improve his television skills. And Nixon, you know, was impressed by this young dynamo and said, well, I'm going to hire this kid to teach me TV. Well, I went back and I re-reported that episode. It's a wonderful story. It shows Ailes' wit and his charm. But in fact, there was no belly dancer on the show that day. I consulted the show logs from the Mike Douglas Show. I interviewed his producers and colleagues who were on the set that day. And in reality, the way they tell the story is that Roger Ailes was intensely interested in meeting Richard Nixon. He put him in his office specifically because he wanted to have a private conversation to pitch him on being his media advisor. And Roger Ailes was a fan of the propaganda work of Leni Riefenstahl. He discussed it with a colleague on the Mike Douglas Show, how impressed he was with Leni Riefenstahl's use of camera angles. And already he was thinking about how to use television to amass
political power. She was Hitler's. Riefenstahl made propaganda movies for Hitler. I imagine what he admired was her craft and not her, the ideology behind it.
He was enthralled with her technical abilities. He discussed with a colleague about her savvy use of camera angles, and they called it the hero shot, in which if you position the camera lower than the subject's eye level, facing slightly up, it has this tendency to make the person on the screen seem larger and more impressive. And so it was the technical craft that Riefenstahl had that deployed in her films that Ailes was captivated by. And he used that in his work for Nixon and at Fox. And the use of camera angles is one of his, I mean, at his heart, Ailes is a producer. I mean, he's a powerful political strategist, but he thinks like a producer. And he was in awe of Riefenstahl's use of camera angles and editing to make a point.
So in 1974 and 75, Ailes becomes part of television news, TVN, which you describe as kind of like a wire service for television stations, but it's not just print they produce. I mean, they produce video packages. So for local TV news stations, mm-hmm. they have, you know, national reports that they can run. And this is a network that's funded by Joseph Kors, the bear magnate whose politics are very on the right. And you describe TVN as kind of a prototype for Fox News. You say it passed itself off as having no political agenda, the press release announcing its debut saying it had no philosophical axe to grind, But you say, in fact, it did. What were its politics and how were they expressed?
The secret history of TVN is, I think, essential to understand how television and politics have changed. You know, TVN really created the blueprint of Fox. It was the brainchild of an ABC executive named Robert Pauley, who was disaffected with the mainstream media. He was a Barry Goldwater supporter, a John Birch Society member. And so he went around, Bob Pauley went around and raised money from Joseph Kors and others to create what he hoped would be a balance on the rest of the media. And you see in these documents and these internal memos about how they were going to package the news, you know, they had a plan to send all of their story lineups to a conservative watchdog group called Accuracy in Media for review. They were consulting with former Nixon officials, Pat Buchanan and others. And so they were basically saying, how do we package the news that is going to appeal to a conservative audience? And there's one just a remarkable memo that describes how they would actually produce the news. And I think anyone who watches Fox News now sees the exact same techniques. There's one technique they describe as the hold frame. And then the hold frame is a strategy in which you have an unflattering picture of your subject. So if for Fox, it would be, say, Barack Obama or a Democrat, and you hold that image on the frame. Another technique was called, quote, repetition. And it's described in one memo as the oldest and most effective propaganda technique. And so at TVN, they were writing about how if they repeated the same story over and over again on their news reports, it would become a national issue. And I think at Fox, you can see that with their relentless coverage of storylines like the Fast and Furious gun-running scandal or the terror attack in Benghazi or the ongoing fallout from some failed green energy projects like Solyndra's. Repetitive storylines are ways to create political issues. One other technique I think is essential to understanding Fox, they pioneered at TVN, according to an internal memo, it's called, quote, whipping posts. And so the conservatives at TVN felt that the CIA and the FBI in the 1970s had become kind of boogeymen for the left. So they would come up with their own, quote, whipping posts. And they selected, for example, the HUD agency and some inner city welfare programs. So they would come up with their own kind of enemies list. And the right would, you know, go after the EPA and these kinds of the Department of Education would be another one. So whipping posts was essential. And then the final point, and this is what I was taken with reading these memos that are, you know, more than three decades old, is sex appeal. One TVN consultant writes how this is, quote, one of the most important elements which we should not ignore. And so you see as they're building this fledgling news service to have a political outcome, they're incorporating all these propaganda elements, pretense balancing, whipping posts, but most importantly, sex appeal. And anyone who turns on Fox will see that the female anchors are very attractive. They're often blonde. They have a lot of personality, and that's the way Ailes programs it to appeal to a mostly white, middle-class male audience. And sex appeal is at the heart of one of the reasons why Fox is such an successful at transmitting political messages.
So you say that Fox News is very rigid when it comes to leaks. It doesn't want its people to leak how Fox News operates, what happens behind the scenes. And you say that Roger Ailes has an assistant who helps police leaks. So what's the system that you're describing?
Well, one of the most powerful executives inside Fox News is a woman named Judy Laterza. She's Roger Ailes' executive assistant. She has worked with him since the 1980s. And she attends virtually every meeting and takes notes of the proceedings. And when Ailes would say something explosive, something like Mitt Romney is like Chinese food, you know, 20 minutes after you meet him, you don't know what you've had, or Barack Obama hates capitalism or global warming is a conspiracy. I mean, these are the kind of monologues that he delivers in these meetings. Judy Laterza will write down what Roger Ailes said. And as one source told me, you know, she'll roll her eyes because she's heard it all before. She'll write down what he says. And then tellingly, she will write down a list of every single person who is in that room so that Roger Ailes has a written record of his comments in these meetings and an attendance list so that if it appears in the press, he can consult his notes and then go interrogate every person who possibly could have been a source of that leak. And that kind of surveillance society chills these men who are making hundreds of thousands and in some cases millions of dollars into silence. And it was the hardest reporting challenge of my career to crack that code of silence. But I think, you know, it's a window into the secretive world that Ailes has been able to create, that he is able to get his political views directly injected into the news without it being revealed to the wider public.
You say that Roger Ailes said at a meeting with executives that it's fine that Fox is making a lot of money, but what he wants to do is elect the next president. And then you go on to describe, in a way, how he tried to recruit somebody who he thought would be a viable candidate. Do you think he was trying to recruit a candidate?
Oh, I know that he was. You know, the mission of Fox really changed in the Obama years. It became ultimately a political organization. And Ailes wanted for his legacy to defeat Obama and propel a Republican to the White House. So he set out to recruit Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who's going through his own political crisis at the moment. But at the time, he was very popular. And Ailes' other preferred candidate was General David Petraeus, who at the time was the head of the Allied forces in Afghanistan. And he sent an emissary to Kabul to have a secret meeting to lobby Petraeus to consider running. Both those men decided to sit out the race. And what it showed is the limits of Ailes' power. And the story of 2012 in Fox News is that Ailes had created the most profitable cable news network, the most powerful political machine, but what made him power ultimately has destroyed his party's ability to win, at least in the last cycle, a national election, because the brand of the Republican Party had become so associated with the extreme voices that Ailes had given airtime to on Fox that moderate candidates like Christie, like Petraeus, did not want to jump into the race. And then so Ailes was forced to back a candidate, Mitt Romney, who he had very little enthusiasm for. To his face, he told Romney that he needed to lighten up and stop being such a preppy. He said to another Fox personality, you know, no one ever wanted to know more about Mitt Romney. I mean, these are kind of indicting words. And the fact that Romney lost and Obama was able to counteract this machine that was set up to attack him is a testament to the fact that, you know, Ailes thrived in a world where, you know, he could keep the old Nixon silent majority together. But we're now, that audience is aging. Fox's audience is aging. A new audience is rising. And Ailes is ultimately clinging to power. He's presiding over an empire that's built in a large measure on a crumbling foundation. So the story of 2012 is a story of failure for him.
You made an assumption that when Petraeus and Christie declined to take Ailes' advice and run in the Republican presidential primary, that it was because they didn't want to be associated with Fox News or with the conservative principles that Fox News represented. Do you know for sure that that's the reason why they decided not to run? They probably had lots of reasons, don't you think?
There were multiple reasons. I think, you know, people who sat out the 2012 race thought maybe an open election in 2016 may be more favorable, but it's undeniable that the brand of the Republican Party going into 2012 had been sullied by the extreme voices on the right that had dominated the debate. And so going into that, you know, it would be more favorable to wait instead of running against, you know, a historic president, the first African-American president in American history. And the moderate voices on the right did not see 2012 as a favorable environment for them. And Ailes tried to draft Christie on two occasions. He had a private meeting at his house in upstate New York, and he lobbied him. And he had a second follow-up conversation in which he lobbied him aggressively to get into the race and ultimately was unsuccessful.
Roger Ailes is not happy with your book, and he said, your publisher, Random House, refused to fact-check the content with me or Fox News. That tells you everything you need to know about this book and its agenda. What's your side of that?
Well, Terry, I reached out to Roger Ailes more than a dozen times in the 2.5 years I was doing the researching and writing, both in person and in writing. I traveled to different states to see him at public events to tell him I would eager to sit down and discuss every fact in the book. Ultimately, it was his decision not to participate with the book and to participate in the fact-checking.
Well, I think he might be implying that if you were doing your job, you would have handed over a manuscript to Ailes or to others at Fox News so that they could fact-check it for you and then get back to you.
No, that's not the way journalism works. I would not turn over a manuscript. I had a team of two fact-checkers spend more than 2,000 hours vetting the manuscript, talking to sources, consulting all of my research material, and I kept Roger Ailes abreast of my reporting, and he knew what was going to be in the book. You know, I sources would report back to him what I was working on. He knew it was going to be a probing look at his life and career. And I offered to sit down and go through every single fact in the book, and he is the one who declined. So that is reflective of his, it was a battle for control, control over his story. And while I can appreciate his point of view, I was not going to cede that control. My responsibility is to my readers. And I fact-checked the book. It is rigorous. And ultimately, he decided that he did not want to engage with my project.
What's it like for you to be kind of in the vortex now of like the political culture wars?
You know, it's been a crash course in what it must be like to be involved in a political campaign, which as a reporter is an odd place to be because I'm not the story. Roger Ailes is the story. But he has elevated me to a place where it's this kind of me versus him dynamic. Very early on into the reporting, I started to see attacks on me on right-wing media sites. There has been a concerted campaign from the right through surrogates of Ailes and Fox to demonize me as some left-wing activist who's on the payroll of George Soros, and it's just a completely distorted picture of me and my journalism. And I think that's, again, tying back into this issue of control. This was an effort to try to malign me in the eyes of the conservative audience that watches Fox, because it makes me wonder, what is Roger Ailes scared of? What wouldn't he want people to know about him that's in my book, and why would he try to, through his surrogates and emissaries, color and shade my journalism? And, you know, there was one anonymous smear on a website that described me as, quote, Jason Blair on steroids, and referring obviously to the disgraced former New York Times reporter who had been fired for fabricating stories. And I found out through my reporting that that comment was made by Ailes' deputy, Bill Shine, in a meeting with Ailes. And within 24 hours of Bill Shine repeating that line, it showed up on a right-wing website. So I could see these attacks emanating from within the building. And it was more revealing of my subject. It was in a way that Ailes did not intend it. He was revealing himself to me and confirming my own reporting.
Gabriel Sherman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Gabriel Sherman speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Sherman's new book about Roger Ailes is called The Loudest Voice in the Room. Sherman is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. You can hear the full interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Roseanne Cash's new album, The River and the Thread, is her first record of original material since her 2006 recording, Black Cadillac. It's based on a series of trips she took in recent years throughout the South. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I'm going down to Florence, gonna wear a pretty dress. I'll sit atop the magic wall with the voices in my head. Then we'll drive on through to Memphis, past the strongest shows. Then on to Arkansas, just to touch the gumbo. A stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
For the past two decades, Roseanne Cash has lived with her family in Manhattan. But in 2008, she was asked if she wanted to help with a project to restore the childhood home of her father, Johnny Cash, in the small town of Diaz, Arkansas. She agreed, went down there to do some fundraising, and in the process, she and her husband, producer, songwriter, guitarist John Leventhal, took some car trips throughout the South, soaking up history and music. The creative result is The River and the Thread, an album that works as a travelogue, a series of vivid history lessons, a memory piece.
Well, you're not from around here. Christmas and other things you'll find won't fit your old ideas. They're aligning shifting sands. You walk across a ghostly bridge to a the crumbling promised land. If Jesus came from Mississippi, if tears began to rise, I guess I'll start at the beginning. It's a world of strange design.
Throughout this album, Cash and Leventhal, she wrote most of the lyrics, he wrote most of the music, have found canny mixtures of country, folk, rock, pop, and even jazz to create atmospheric songs about things they saw and remarks they overheard. One of the album's most striking compositions is Money Road. It's a road in Mississippi where, within the space of a few miles, can be located three important cultural occurrences: the site of what is now considered the grave of blues innovator Robert Johnson, the grocery store in which the black youth Emmett Till flirted with a white woman and was hung for that transgression in 1955, and the Tallahatchie Bridge, the site of Ode to Billy Joe, Bobby Gentry's 1967 hit about two lovers who drop something forever mysterious off that bridge. The result is an eerie, evocative piece of music that braids all these strands together.
I was dreaming about the Tallahatchie Bridge. From where we live, but the long night at the pearly gate, the keepers of our fate, none of them will congregate out on Money Road.
All is not spooky ominousness, to be sure. The album is filled with lovely melodies and vocal performances that match anything Cash recorded at the height of her 1980s fame on hits like 7 Year Ache. Take, for example, this beautiful song, 50,000 Watts, a kind of gospel song with a shuffle beat.
It's a hard road, but it fits your shoes. Son of rhythm, brother of the pull of the oak. Everything is broken and painted in smoke.
One of the recurring themes of The River and the Thread is the notion that music can be a repository for history, as well as a way to heal old wounds, old heartache. On When the Master Calls the Roll, two lovers, based loosely on two of Cash's relatives from the Civil War era, are reunited in death, in everlasting bliss. On other songs, that kind of healing works on narrators grappling with contemporary struggles. Taken together, the result is a concept album, a timeless work of comfort and quiet joy.
Ken Tucker reviewed Roseanne Cash's new album, The River and the Thread. Coming up, Justice Sonia Sotomayor talks about her beginnings growing up in the South Bronx to becoming the first Hispanic justice on the Supreme Court. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Like most sitting Supreme Court justices, our next guest, Sonia Sotomayor, is circumspect when talking about the court. But she's attempted to venture more intimately into her personal life in her new memoir, My Beloved World, which became a bestseller when it was published last year. Terry spoke with Justice Sotomayor last Monday, shortly after the book was released in paperback. Her memoir is about growing up poor in the South Bronx, living with a chronic disease, juvenile diabetes, being raised by a single mother after her father, who was an alcoholic, died, and struggling to get a good education in spite of the odds. Her cousin, who she was very close to, became a heroin addict and died of AIDS. The book ends with the U.S. Senate confirming her nomination to the District Court for the Southern District of New York, becoming the first Hispanic federal judge in the state's history. In the epilogue, she describes taking the oath of office for the Supreme Court, becoming the first Hispanic and the third woman to serve on the court.
Justice Sotomayor, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such an honor to have you on our show. So before we start, explain to us what is off limits for you as a sitting justice, the kinds of things that you would decline to discuss on our show.
Terry, I believe that the public's perception of a justice is impacted negatively if a justice opines on issues that are before the court or issues that are likely to come before the court. The reason for this is we decide cases based on the arguments parties raise. And to the extent that we come to our decision-making with preconceived notions about an issue, the public rightly has a perception that we may have prejudged the question. And so I'm very, very careful and don't answer questions relating to pending cases or cases that might come before the court.
And what about the topic of decisions you've already voted on?
I don't tend to talk about them because, and this is more personal, sometimes I will talk about an issue in terms of giving its background. But my own feeling is that my opinions are pretty clear in explaining why I voted one way or another. And none of my colleagues are shy about stating their views and the reasons for those views.
So you've told us some of the things you declined to talk about. As you point out in your own memoir, you have ventured to write more intimately about your personal life than is customary for a member of the Supreme Court. Why have you chosen to do that?
When I was nominated by the president for this position, it became very clear to me that many people in the public were interested in my life. And I also realized that much of the public perception of who I was and what had happened to me was not quite complete. It was based more on assumptions rather than realities. The very first moment in which I started to think about writing a book happened during an interview. It was within months of being placed on the court, and the interviewer asked me how my happy life had affected my success. And I had to pause because I hadn't really perceived myself as having had a traditionally happy childhood. And I realized that what the public had seen during my nomination was a deep closeness to my mother and my other members of my family. But what the public had not realized was how hard we had worked to come to that point, and that it wasn't filled with just an easy road of happiness, that it was filled with challenges and difficulties that we had to overcome as a family.
You had a cousin who was a heroin addict, and you ask yourself in your book, you know, how did you succeed in the way you did when he became an addict in the way he did, and you thought he was very smart, and you basically had the same kind of upbringing and in the same neighborhood. What conclusions have you come to about that?
I think there's always a discussion about nature versus nurturing, but I do believe that it's always a combination of the two that impact what happens to a person. For me, I was blessed, unlike my cousin Nelson, with being a girl. My family was more protective of me. I wasn't permitted to play outside alone. It was a different world for the boys in the family. They were permitted to go out, and given the neighborhood and the temptations in it, it would have been, I think, even different for me if I had not been protected in the way Nelson wasn't. I also think that each child has to have within them a desire to achieve something. And for me, my initial goals were just to graduate from college because nobody in my family had done it. But the idea of having a mark that I wanted to achieve helped me. Nelson couldn't find that in his life. He loved being a musician. Regrettably, his father wanted him to be a doctor. And their dreams clashed. And I think Nelson never found the support that he needed to give reality to his dreams.
So your cousin Nelson, your late cousin Nelson, who died of AIDS, was a heroin addict. Your father was an alcoholic, and that was a cause of a lot of the fighting between your parents. He died when he was 42 and when you were 9. And I don't know if you consider this question off limits or not, but has it been helpful in your career as a judge and now as a Supreme Court justice to have had people you were, you know, so close with, members of your family who had problems with addiction, drugs or alcohol? There are so many legal decisions and, you know, pertaining to the use and the sale of drugs and the treatment of people, you know, like punishment versus medical treatment of people who have addiction problems. And, you know, many people have no firsthand observation of that, and you do. So I'm wondering if that's been helpful as a judge.
I think that my experiences as a child and my experiences as they impacted me growing up was coming to an understanding that good people do bad things. I watched my father, who I knew loved me, kill himself with alcohol. I watched a cousin whom I adored, who I thought of as my soulmate as a child, who had an enormous talent and a great intelligence, and yet I watched him destroy himself and affect his family with a great deal of pain by ultimately killing himself with drug use. That has always permitted me to do two things as a judge. First, to understand that the people who came before me as defendants were human beings with good and potentially very bad things within them. And it was not unusual for defendants to have families who depended on them, who loved them, who thought the world of them, even though they had done horrific things. Now, your question, Terry, suggested that it make me more sympathetic or more lenient towards defendants because of this recognition. I actually don't think so. And so as a judge, I was quite surprised at one point in my career when I was being nominated to the Court of Appeals, I was asked for the Senate to give them a record of how often I had departed from the then mandatory sentencing guidelines. And judges were permitted under certain circumstances to depart downward, give a lesser sentence, or depart upwards, give a higher sentence than the guidelines called for. And I was shocked to find that I gave less downward departure, lesser sentences, and more greater sentences than the national average. I wasn't aspiring to this statistic. It's just the way it was. I think that because of my experiences, however, I could treat that person in my courtroom as an individual and not as a non-entity, and at the same time hold them responsible for their acts.
Interesting. Thank you for talking about that. My guest is Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and her memoir, My Beloved World, has just been published in paperback. So when you were in Yale Law School, you didn't raise your hand in class until your third year. You're not shy. You're certainly not inarticulate. Why did it take you 3 years to raise your hand?
Well, first of all, you're assuming that who I am today, I was back then. And I don't know that I've ever been shy, but I was a much more self-contained and less outgoing person in the earlier parts of my life. It took real effort for me to come out of some of the protective layers I had put on because of the difficulties in my childhood. and some of the emotional withdrawal that I had to do to survive, it took a good part of my life to learn how to shed some of that and how to become a more people person. But I had some measure of self-confidence, but not enough to feel secure among my very brilliant Yale classmates. Spent a whole lot of time in law school feeling inadequate and not quite sure that I measured up to the accomplishments of my classmates.
What was the question you finally asked when you raised it?
Well, it was a math question. My dad was quite skilled in math. And he had taught me some math shortcuts, and I think that that has something to do with my abilities in geometry and algebra. But at any rate, the professor was trying to explain this arcane rule called rules against perpetuity, which has to do with how far in the future.
I
know,
here.
It's a real legalese,
isn't it? Yeah, maybe we should skip this, yeah.
Yeah, but how far in the future you can leave your property to your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. That's the essence of it.
Right.
But it's really a math problem.
Right, okay.
And he did the math problem up on the board, and I kept looking at it and realizing, this isn't quite right. So I raised my hand and said to him, Professor, didn't you tell us this was the rule? And he said, yes. And I said, well, your example doesn't fit the rule. And I walked him through it, and he stood up there looking at the example and looked at it and looked at it and finally turned around and said to me, you're right. I've been teaching this for more than 20 or 30 years, and I never realized that. At any rate.
Well, that was your first question. And
that was my first question.
Yale Law School.
That was my first interchange
volunteered
with a professor.
Well, I will say you do have a reputation on the bench for asking tough questions.
Well, when I ask tough questions on the bench, and I think there's a bunch of lawyers who understand this, it's because I'm grappling with the tough issues in the case. And for me, the tough question is an opportunity for the lawyer to give me the answer that will satisfy me, to give me the answer that makes sense. And I will push a lawyer to see how far their thesis holds up. It's not an attempt to embarrass the lawyer. It's an attempt for me to understand what their argument is. I never want to walk away from anything I do, but particularly from deciding a case, without fully understanding every facet of it and ensuring that the lawyer has given me the best answer that they can about a legal issue.
You have been in several positions where you've been the first Latino to serve. What does that bring a sense of any like special responsibility or anything? Or do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I think you have to. Yes. You have to work harder. And in part by that question that man asked, in every position that I've been in, there have been naysayers who don't believe I'm qualified or who don't believe I can do the work. And I feel a special responsibility to prove them wrong. And I think I work harder than a lot of other people because of that sense of responsibility. Does it mean that I think that I have an obligation to any particular group, including Latinos? No, my job is my job, and particularly being a judge, I would be doing a disservice to the Latino community if I ruled on the basis of a preference for any group, whether it's them or anyone else. I have to rule as I do on the basis of the law and of precedence and what the law commands me to do. But I do think I'd feel a special responsibility to work harder to prove myself because I am the first of a group that has been perceived as being incapable of doing whatever it is that I've had the benefit of becoming a part of.
You write in the book that when you were in the DA's office in New York that, sure, you know, you were on one side and the defense attorneys were on another, but you were friends, and what you agreed on was the law. and that the law should be followed. And you took opposite sides, but the foundation was the law. Now you're on the Supreme Court, and, you know, same thing. The foundation is the law. But the judicial philosophies of the people on the bench are so widely on opposite sides in some cases that, you know, it's hard to say if you can even agree on what the law is, because the interpretation of the law is so opposing. And I'm wondering if you could address that at all about, you know, finding on controversial cases what it's like to, I don't even know what the debates are like or what the arguments are like, you know, among the justices themselves.
Well, what's very interesting is that most people read our opinions, which can be at moments rather animated. And many people who read our opinions think we have to be at each other's necks constantly. It's interesting we're not. When we're talking about cases at our conference, it's generally a conversation. It's really a talk about what our perspectives are and why we have reached the conclusions we've reached. As we go around the room, we're explaining our vote and we're attempting to persuade each other of the rightness of our views. Clearly, if you have a difference of approach, you might not be able to shorten the gap between you. But at essence, the reason it can remain a conversation is that we have a fundamental respect for each other.
Well, Justice Sotomayor, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor speaking with Terry Gross last Monday about her memoir, My Beloved World. It's just been released in paperback. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.